So I get to keep you all awake first thing in the morning, make sure that I don't drive you to sleep before the rest of the presentations. So first question for you, and I'll get into who I am and a little bit more about Coverity in a little bit, but yesterday was Earth Day. Who remembered that? So a few people. So the point of Earth Day is that some people said, here's something that people tend to overlook on a day-to-day basis. It's not something that they think about, you know, in their life. There are these environmental issues, and once a year we want to set aside a day and draw your attention back to those things. So today I'm going to talk about something else that we tend to overlook on a day-to-day basis and draw your attention back to that. And it's those little small things that people tend to miss, like this. Anybody want to guess what that number is?
Subsidies for banks.
No, it's missing some zeros. That particular number was an estimate made in the U.S. by the National Institute for Standards and Technology on the cost of software defects in 1 year, and that was for 2002. I looked for numbers in Europe, and I couldn't find any studies that gave a similar number, but obviously that's a fairly large amount of money. And yet, you know, software defects, we don't necessarily think about, right? We become used to them. It's just something that you deal with, and you move forward. So it is something that would, you know, be nice to address, and that's the big picture. You know, if we were to take a look at things a little bit more smaller, a little bit, you know, on an individual scale, does anybody want to guess what that number is? This was a study done by Hewlett-Packard in 1991, and they published a journal article where they said that the cost of a single software defect for them on a set of projects that they looked at historically was $10,500. And that worked out to about $1,500 for actual time that the programmers spent on reworking the code to address the software defects, and then about $9,000 of lost opportunity, lost profit, because the software was delayed or not available for, you know, particular customer opportunities and that sort of thing. Now, there have been other studies that come up with, you know, other numbers, but they're often not too far out of this range. And of course, when you look at each individual defect, it depends on when you catch them. If you catch them earlier in the software development process, then you'll save a lot of that money. If it's something that goes out into the field, it may end up costing you a lot more than that. So what does Coverity do? Coverity is just reaching the point where we can actually start to talk about our bigger picture for what we're trying to accomplish in the software development space. But the first thing that people know us for is our static analysis tools. And that is the ability to take source code and look at it without running it and find defects in the code base. And essentially the way that we do that is through these three steps, which are path simulation, essentially looking at the code and through our analysis tools, looking at every possible path that can be executed in that code. Data flow analysis, so not only looking at the paths through the code, but seeing how the various variables have various values, how that affects the paths through the code. And then putting those two things together and doing false path pruning, essentially finding places in the code where you can never get here from there because there's no set of variables that allows that to ever happen. All of those things are very important because if you want to analyze the code for every situation that can occur without having to write a test case that introduces the data set that, you know, takes you down that path, you need to be able to look at every path. But at the same time, you don't want to report errors that happen, you know, after you walk through the exit call because, you know, that doesn't occur. So all of these things are very important. Why are we doing this for open source? Well, it started because there was a contract from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security to do that. A lot of people are sometimes very surprised by this if they haven't heard about the story. Essentially, the Department of Homeland Security said, we realize that this open source software is so widely used that it affects the national infrastructure. So we're going to put money behind that and say, this is something that needs to be addressed. And, you know, we're investigating various tools, various approaches, both reactive, you know, how we deal with software defects once they're found, vulnerabilities that are published, but also trying to do things in a proactive way and saying, what can we do to look at the source code to make it, you know, more hardened so that it's not vulnerable to attack in the first place? So to date, and we started in March of 2006 with a website and providing the service to the various open source projects, there have been over 8,500 defects that have been fixed in open source that were identified through the Coverity analysis. So we're very happy with that result. We think it's very tangible, especially when you multiply that times the 10,500 number and think about, you know, the potential costs that have been saved. You know, and perhaps in a project like Samba, you know, because Samba is not necessarily being sold itself, it's not Samba who would have cost the profit, you know, opportunity lost, but it's customers who use Samba and build other products using it. So the world of programming is a very different place. If you think about other trade skills like carpentry, carpentry has been unchanged for a very long time. If you look at the set of tools that a carpenter has today, they're essentially the same tools that they would have had 6 centuries ago. You know, yes, the tools maybe are made of new materials and they're a little bit better quality than they were and they've been refined in certain ways, but fundamentally it's the same set of tools. This is very different in software because not only are we continuing to develop newer tools all the time, but in fact the tools that we build allow us to develop newer computers. And so the materials that we work with, the wood, in essence, are changing all the time, right? The techniques that we use to optimize our code today are not the same things that made sense to optimize machines that people had 20 years ago. So as a technology, software development as a career path is a very young, very new thing. You know, we can't by any means say that we've reached a point where our tools haven't changed for 600 years yet. And I don't expect that we will for a very long time. So that's one of the interesting things about software is that we get to build our own tools. You know, when we encounter a problem, we can use computers as the tool to create better tools for ourselves. I'm actually learning blacksmithing at the moment. And one of the very first things that they have you do is make nails. So you just learn the basics of turning, you know, round steel into square steel, turning square steel into round steel. But the next thing that you do is learning to make tongs so that you can build tools for your own forge. So you start, you know, borrowing somebody else's tools, but you immediately begin to build up your own set of tools. And I think that's very similar in software. You know, you find someone else who can loan you something to get you started, and then you build up a set of tools that works for you. And I think that fits very well in the environment of Samba. You know, where people have developed software because they had a problem that they needed to solve and they've built tools that address that. So here we are today in Göttingen. And I looked into the history of Göttingen and a couple of the characters that I found out about were professors at the university here who were the Brothers Grimm, who you probably know from fairy tales. I think they're very, you know, widely known around the world, and Hansel and Gretel is one of those. And I think you probably know the story. You know, I won't go through the whole thing, but brother and sister, you know, taken out in the woods, have to find their way back. They leave themselves a trail of pebbles the first time. And then the pebbles are taken away from them. So like good engineers, they find another solution. They use some breadcrumbs. Turned out there was a problem with that. But if you think about software development, we've gone through the same kind of process, right? People started out doing things, you know, one way, and over time they've found, you know, here's a problem that we have to solve. Let's find a new way of doing this. And I was having a conversation in the hall yesterday about tools like version control, you know, and early on people had, you know, no version control, and then they had file-based version control, and then they had project-based version control, and now they have distributed project-based version control. And so we use this because we want that little bit of history. We want that trail of breadcrumbs to lead you back to how did the code end up being the way that it is today. And we found that that's a very useful thing to have. So there are tools that people have built for working with software that have gradually become part of the normal way we deal with software. Version control, bug trackers, debuggers. You know, if someone had said to me, you know, when I was growing up, that I was going to be using things like this, you know, it would have made no sense because the words didn't mean anything. you know, a phrase that's been thrown around lately is that, you know, we're training students today to have careers in jobs that don't exist yet, because the world is just changing that fast. You know, when I was in grade school, you never would have said that I'd learn web development, because it didn't mean anything. Right? So what am I actually going to tell you about today? So at Coverity, we've been doing this analysis of open source code. And I'll come back to this in a second. So let me tell you about myself. I actually work on an open source project as well. I'm a developer on NetBSD. And I've just started a two-year term on the board of directors for the NetBSD Foundation as well. And so I had exposure to Coverity because they were offering their tools to FreeBSD, and I knew people who were working on FreeBSD. And I got in touch with Coverity and said, you know, could we get access to these for NetBSD as well? And that's how I ended up knowing the people at Coverity. And so the fact that I've ended up, you know, working for Coverity, managing the project of dealing with the other open source projects is great, because it's all getting to know people in other projects that I like dealing with anyway, because you're like NetBSD people even if you're working on a different project. And so as we've been analyzing all of this open source code, you know, we've been collecting the information, and then we've gone back and said, all right, you know, now that we've done this, now that we've seen the results of analyzing all this code, what can we learn from that? How can we constantly go through this process of improving our own tools? You know, just like today, you might be familiar with all of these tools. I would suggest that other tools, like the things that Coverity are building, static analysis and dynamic analysis tools, build analysis and architectural analysis tools, are going to become part of a standard developer's toolkit before very long. So one of the things that we've done is we've said, let's take a look at all of that source code that we've been analyzing. In this case, over 55 million lines of code from the different projects that we've looked at, nearly 10 billion lines of code analyzed. That's about 14,000 different builds of the software, and a wide variety of open source projects. And let's take a look at what we can learn from that, you know, and let's see where we have assumptions about how programming works, how software works, and let's see if there's some information in here that we can dig out. So you don't need to make notes about this part of things, because there's actually a white paper that we released last year that has more than enough detail. It will tell you everything that you ever want to know. So just enjoy the information here, and you can look it up if you want to read the whole thing. So let's talk about length of functions. This was something that we thought was interesting, because people sometimes promulgate this theory that long functions are bad because people are more likely to make mistakes in them. So you refactor your code into smaller pieces and you'll have fewer errors in it. So we said, well, that's interesting. We now have an empirical data set where we can test that question and see whether it's actually true or not. So, you know, first of all, why is a function long? Because functions can be long for several different reasons. You know, is it that all of the code in the function actually gets run, or is it a big switch statement and only a small piece of code is actually being run, even though the function itself is lengthy? You know, is it a large sequential set of operations? That's a different matter. Right? So there might be more than one reason for code to be long, and maybe we'll find differences when we look at that. So across all the projects in the scan, when we averaged out the function lengths, we found that the shortest average function length was about 14 lines, and the longest average function length was 345 lines. So we were surprised by that to begin with, because it's a, you know, 25x difference from the low end to the high end, which, you know, was a lot broader than we would have guesstimated at. And when we graph that compared to the defect density in those projects, and by defect density, I mean the number of defects per 1,000 lines of code, we would have expected, if the statement was true that longer functions mean you have more defects, that we would have a traditional up and to the right line on this graph, and we would see, you know, as you go over to the right and you have longer functions, you have, you know, higher density of bugs. But as you can see by looking at this, that really didn't turn out to be the case. Now, obviously, there are a smaller number of projects that have the really long functions, but even down here at the end, you can see that when you do a statistical correlation on this, there's zero, you know, it's actually 0.49% correlation between function length and defect density. So then, you know, that leads us to start asking new questions. And when we showed this research to some people, they said, you know, this is great because this will prompt people to do new, doctoral work and thesis work in these areas. And ask the questions like, okay, you know, if this is the case, then, you know, why do you want to make functions shorter? You know, maybe there are advantages from an understandability point of view, maintainability, different things that don't affect the defects in the code, but still have other advantages, you know. But one of the discussions we ended up having was the fact that when you take a large function and you split it into pieces, yes, you've reduced the complexity of each of those functions, but you've now added a new interface between them. And so you may have had just as much opportunity to introduce bugs in that interface between the two new functions as you had when it was one large function before. Here's another graph. This is looking at the breadth of projects that we have in the scan. So on the left-hand side, we have projects that have improved their defect density. By using the results of the analysis that we gave them, they've fixed a lot of bugs, and we've been doing the analysis on, you know, a nightly or every other nightly basis since March of 2006. So we've tracked projects from the first time that we built that code base and the number of defects they had and the defect density to the latest run that we've done as of when the report was compiled, which was around May of last year. And we've seen, you know, there are a number of projects over here on the left-hand side with a vast improvement in defect density, and that makes us very happy. And then there are some projects over on the right-hand side that do something a little bit unexpected. They're even below the zero point on the graph. So although we've been analyzing the software on an ongoing basis and tracking the defects that are in the code, the developers haven't been making use of it. And so they've been adding new features to the code and introducing additional defects, and their defect density has actually gotten worse. So on the one hand, it's kind of nice to have a sort of control group in that sense, where we're looking at those projects. They haven't been using the tools, so we can see what happens to software over time if you don't take care of software quality as something that you pay attention to. And on the left-hand side, you know, we have the projects that are doing well. By the way, I meant to say at the very beginning, feel free to ask questions during the presentation. There's no reason for me to wait till the end. I'm happy to deal with them as they come up. So if anyone has any questions, feel free to shout them out. Yes? This, so in this particular report, the question is, what languages are involved here? Is this C or C++? And this particular report was all C and C++ projects. We also have some Java projects in scan, but there were fewer of them. And so, you know, we didn't think there was enough statistical significance to investigate there yet. Over time, we hope to add more Java projects, and then we'll do that as well. So the question is, did we differentiate between C and C++, or did we group them as a whole? We just grouped them as a whole for the moment. There are a number of cases where we investigated certain things in this report that led us to have new questions, and so we expect to do follow-up reports to this one where we dig into specific areas in more depth. For example, the average function length question, you know, one of the questions that come up to us is, all right, so, you know, on an average function length basis, you have this graph where there's no correlation between the two things, but the actual defects in the code, are they in the longer functions versus not being in the shorter functions in an individual project? And so doing that at a per function level is something that we'll be likely to do in the future. And other things, breaking things down per language, breaking things down per types of operations, or other sorts of things we'll be looking at. So there was a question that I thought somebody might ask here. And I hear some laughter, which means people are probably thinking of it. So this, what is it? Go ahead, speak up. Who are those guys? Well, all of the research done for this report was done with the data blinded, because we didn't want to know who it was and be influenced by that. And also, when standing on stage, I never wanted to be able to answer the question, who are those guys? So I actually don't know who any of the bars on the screen are. All right, just so long as that's clear. So this is another piece of data that we had in the report, and we broke down the different types of defects that we identify in the code bases and how frequent each of those are. And then we started to ask some questions about, you know, why is it that certain types of defects are more common than others? You know, one of the possible thoughts here, for example, is that we have null pointer dereferences and resource leaks as making up more than 50% of the defects identified, and then other things like reading uninitialized values are a much smaller percent, down at 5.5. So one of the possible reasons for that is that if you think about the way code is written, you only have one opportunity to access an uninitialized value, because you define the variable and then either you assign something to it or you read it before you do. Whereas pointer dereferences, you do all throughout the code all the time, and so you have lots of opportunities to make a mistake and dereference a pointer that's null. So one of the things that we want to look at in the future is to see how closely correlated the frequency percentages of these different defect types are to the actions in the code that allow you to make that mistake, and find out whether certain types of mistakes are more prevalent because, you know, programmers have a harder time thinking of that, or whether it's simply, you know, you use pointers more often, you make mistakes with pointers more often. This was another analysis that we did. When we're capturing the information about the code, we also capture things like cyclomatic complexity and Halstead effort. And so we wanted to know what was the relationship between the cyclomatic complexity and the size of the code base. And it turned out that this was really strongly correlated. I forget the number off the top of my head right now. I think it was on the order of 85 to 87%, which is interesting because a lot of people will look at a complexity metric and assume that they know what it means and say, well, this complexity metric is large, therefore my code is more complex. But what this graph shows you is that, you know, perhaps, in fact, what it's telling you is you have more code. And so if you're using the complexity metric as a way to measure, you know, how difficult a particular coding effort is, you need to take into account how large is your project compared to other projects of the same size. You know, how is my complexity metric, you know, versus the baseline for this much code? And people have used complexity metrics over the years for things like estimating how much time they need in their schedule for debugging. We're going to write a project of this size, it's, you know, going to be this complex, therefore we need this many weeks of debugging time. And so it's interesting to look at these statistics and ask the question of whether these numbers really mean what people think they mean. And, you know, Coverity sells our analysis tools to commercial entities that develop software. So that's how we make our money, that's our business model. People are sometimes confused when they hear, you know, that we're working with open source, and that was certainly initiated by the DHS contract, but our main business is commercial software sales. And so the interesting thing about us in working with open source is that with the commercial customers, we don't get to see their code. They buy the tools, they run them in-house, and, you know, other than them calling us for support once in a while, you know, we don't see what they're doing with the tools, how they use them, you know, or what the results are. Working with the open source projects, we get a lot more information about how the tools actually work for people. We get feedback, and we can see the kind of results that they're producing. And we also have, you know, can collect data like this that we can do more analysis on and say, you know, where are the challenges for the developer? How can we make the tools even better to help them more in the future? This is just a slide I put up. We presented this research information to various analyst organizations, so if any of you are on the corporate side of things and you want to ask questions of an analyst, there are people that you can talk to see what they thought of this research. We got really good feedback about it from them. Was there a question? I thought I heard a cough. So what are some of the summaries from the report? So the first thing was that, you know, when we look back at that chart of the projects that improved and the projects that regressed, the sum under the curve is about a 16% improvement over the 2 years from March of 2006 to May of 2007, 2008, when these statistics were gathered. So overall, that's a good improvement in quality. Yes, some projects improved more than others. Different types of defects have different levels of prevalence. And overall, the false positive rate identified to date, which is a common question when it comes to static analysis, because there are some things that are undecidable statically, is currently sitting about 14%. So the contract with DHS is over. The 3 years have run its course. And so a lot of people ask the question, you know, what's going to happen now? The answer to that is very simple. the scan is going to continue and we're going to continue to grow it. You know, Coverity is going to support it, and we're also looking for partner organizations that want to participate in some way. So if you're working with a company that you think should be involved in this effort, if you have other development tools, you know, that you would like to offer in a similar way, you could work together with us and help support this effort. You know, or if you want to contribute hardware, money, or time, or whatever, you know, get in touch. So let me talk a little bit about the analysis itself. And I have a few slides here that have a lot of text on them. I won't, you know, go through them all, but as I said, this information is all covered in the report. So if you want to read the details, you can take a look at that. The way that we do the analysis of the code is very much the same as what the front end of a compiler does. So we parse the code, we turn it into an abstract syntax tree, but then instead of running the back end of a compiler where we generate executable machine code out of it, what we do is we walk over the abstract syntax tree to do our various types of checks. So we're looking for certain sequences of events, such as you allocate a pointer, and then you free the pointer, and then you access the pointer again after it's been freed. You know, that sequence of events is bad. You're accessing memory that's been freed. You're going to corrupt things, and unpredictable behavior will happen down the line. Those are the types of issues that are normally a pain to deal with in a runtime debugger environment, because you don't find out that there's a problem until it's too late, whereas statically we can tell you this is the line of code where you access the pointer that's already been freed, and in fact, you know, here's the line of code where you freed it, and here's all of the information about the path between those two points in the code. So it very much gives you a root cause, showing you straight to the problem. Now, one of the questions I meant to say this at some point in time, people might be asking, you know, why am I here at a Samba conference? And the answer is that a lot of the time when people ask me about various open source projects that have been working with the results from the scan, they say, you know, give us an example of, you know, a project that's had good results from this. And my first example is always Samba, because when the first analysis was done in March of 2006, the Samba team fixed all of the identified defects in 9 days. Right? Waste no time. Hey, we see this analysis. That really is a problem. We should fix that. Done. There are a lot of projects that still have long lists of outstanding defects, you know, and we see the security advisories come out, and we say, yeah, that was in our analysis, you know, but nobody got around to looking at it, or nobody got around to dealing with it yet. You know, that's actually the reason why, if you go to the scan website, the detailed analysis information is only available to the developers who work on the project, because there are things in there that are unreleased vulnerabilities. So there's summary information for the general public, you know, how many defects are still outstanding, how many have been fixed, but the actual code analysis results are just for committers on the projects. So all of this, when we started out, Coverity was doing the builds for the various code bases. And that is labor intensive, because maintaining all of the dependencies that change over time and the version control system changes, and now our main development branch is this, can you update so that you're checking that out instead? Those kinds of things take an effort to maintain. If you're just working on one or two open source projects, it's not so bad, but when you're trying to track hundreds of open source projects, it's problematic. So one of the ways that we've worked to eliminate this bottleneck is now to provide developers with what's called self-builds. So we give you a tool that you can run on your own build environment to capture the information from your build process, gather that up into a tarball, and then send it to us, and we can do the analysis on that. And so that means that as long as you can build your own code, we can do the analysis for you. So we don't have to maintain a duplicate of the environment for every open source project anymore. We're still doing that for a lot of them today, but we're gradually migrating, and new projects that we add, we're adding in the self-build model. And so we started doing that in November of last year, and we're going to continue to expand on that as well.
How can you get money on that? I know that you're building all code.
Yeah.
But I also know that it happened in the past that you failed to update properly.
Yeah.
So if you get control over that, like,
yeah.
So who would be the contact for us?
If you go to scan.coverity.com/self-build, you'll find a web page that shows all of the details, and then get in touch with me when you've read through that. So conceptually, what we've done with SCAN is we've structured things as this virtual ladder. We have these various rungs, because as Coverity does new development on new versions of the analysis tools, we upgrade our tools and we're able to find new types of bugs that we didn't find previously. And so how do we roll that out to the project? You know, while maintaining some sense of, you know, what do these numbers mean when we try to compare one project to another. So what we have is the rungs, and on any particular rung of the SCAN ladder, and Samba is on the highest rung, the way that you progress from one rung to another is you fix all of the defects that have been identified with that set of tools, and then we move you up to the next rung, and you get a newer version of the engine, which unfortunately probably identifies more problems in the code. And so we expect that we announced rung 2 in the beginning of 2008, and we expect to be announcing rung 3 before very long. And Samba, I think, has already fixed all of the bugs on rung 2, so they'll be moving up to rung 3 as soon as that's made available as well, which will be a new version of Prevent, more security-specific oriented checkers, more concurrency-oriented checkers, and also a thing called Boolean satisfiability, which is a technique from sort of a technique from the hardware world. Essentially, what we do is we take all of the equations in a piece of code, we turn them into a set of Boolean equations, we solve them, and then if there is no solution for that set of Boolean equations, then there is no way that the code can possibly flow from point A to point B, because there are no set of variables, there's no set of values for all the variables in that code that satisfy the equations. And what that means is it allows us to do things to rule out false paths that you can't rule out with simple data flow analysis. So that's something that's been done for proving hardware in a chip design environment for a long time, but we were the first company to apply it to software. So that'll be rolling out into SCAN in rung 3. Additionally, and I talked to Volker about this in January, we were at a conference in Nuremberg together and we sat down and spent some time looking at the architectural analysis tool that we have. So the same method that we have for collecting information about code to look for defects, we can collect information about the code and then show the structure of the code in a variety of different ways. And so I have some sample screen images from that, but I will just skip through these fairly quickly. This is broken down by directory. You can see the number of references from one directory to another, meaning that all the files in that directory are rolled up into one bundle. In the application interactively, when you click on that number, you actually see the list of all of the functions in the one directory that are calling functions in the other directory. And another way that you can look at that is actually as a graph, where you can either highlight, in this case, just what are called the upwards references, so things that are correct code implementations, such as, you know, callback mechanisms, you know, or circular dependencies, like circular data structures, for example. But oftentimes, things that are upwards references are actually not intentional in the code. They're places where, you know, if you were following a strict layered model, you've called from something in a lower layer into something in a higher layer. And so you can follow each one of these arrows for the functions that are in a particular directory to the functions that are in another directory. And like with the other display, you can click on one of the arrows and see the lists of all the individual functions. And each one of these arrows, if you like, is like a little trail of breadcrumbs that you can follow from one place to another. So I wanted to tell you a story about software defects, because at the beginning of the talk, I talked about the big number, and I talked about the cost of an individual software defect. But aside from the monetary aspect of it, software defects have other effects on our lives. So back in 1991-92 timeframe, I was an IT manager for a computer hardware distributor, and we'd purchased a new Unix system to replace our main machine that was running the entire company. And our application software was written in a particular language. We got the new interpreter for that language to run on the new piece of hardware that we got, and we ported our application and our data set over, and life was good. We were up and running live. And then we started to have errors. And what would happen is the end-of-day processes that we ran, which basically were a batch job overnight to denormalize the data to make for quick reporting and general ledger access, that sort of things, that started to get corruption in the databases. And if the overnight jobs did not finish before the morning started, then, you know, the salespeople couldn't sell anything and people were generally very unhappy. I was talking to somebody yesterday who said that they had been told in a job that they were in that the cost of downtime for this particular banking environment was $1 million an hour. So you can't have a bug, you know, anything that happens, you have to fix it now, fast. And in our environment, it wasn't quite that bad. I'd been told that $40,000 an hour was, you know, the cost of being down for us. But nonetheless, this meant that, you know, if I didn't get the problem fixed in the middle of the night so that the batch jobs could finish, we would have problems in the morning. So what ended up happening was I told the vendor, you know, that we were having this issue, and I said, you know, it didn't happen on the old system, so I'm pretty sure it's something about, you know, the interpreter for the new system that you've sold us. And they said, no, we've tested it, it's fine. Can't possibly be that. And I said, well, but this data corruption never happened on the old system, and we've been running it for years. And they said, no, you know, absolutely not possible. So I went on for about 3 weeks, where I went into the office at 2:30 in the morning, in the middle of the night every day, to figure out whether the corruption had happened that night or not, and fix it, and get the end of day jobs running again so that they'd be finished before 8 o'clock or so when people started coming in. And after about 3 weeks of that, I probably looked something like this. And I realized that the vendor wasn't going to help me. You know, they were simply finger pointing and saying, you know, it's not something we've done, it's something in your application. And I said, all right, I'm gonna have to sit down and solve this. But I didn't have the source code, so I thought this was gonna be a difficult thing for me to do. You know, it's some kind of database corruption problem. How am I going to figure this out? I set up two terminals side by side, and I made a list of steps that I wanted to walk through of, you know, two processes accessing the same database at the same time and see if I could get it down to a set of reproducible steps that I could point to the vendor and say, do this, and you will reproduce the problem. It turned out that, you know, practically the first thing that I tried reproduced the problem, which was if you accessed a key with the one process and you accessed the key and wrote to it with another process, you would end up with a key with no data in it in the table. So it was actually very straightforward to reproduce. And I sent that to them and they said, oh my, that really can happen. And they had a fix for me the next day. But the funny thing is, you know, now I'm working for Coverity, and one of the things that we have are concurrency checkers that look for things like race conditions and would have identified that kind of problem in the code. So we can talk about the dollar value of the cost of a defect, but there's also the impact on people's lives. Because, you know, being up at 2:30 in the morning for 3 weeks worrying about, you know, not only do I have to deal with this right now, but I have to be back in the office for 9 a.m., you know, and work my whole regular day too, this is no fun at all. So what I really want to do is go back to the beginning of this presentation and say, you know, this is the impact on an individual. What about the impact on the world? We had that bigger number of cost of software defects in a year. You know, we have the defects that we don't necessarily think about on a day-to-day basis, but they impact us all the time. So with that, I'll ask you for questions. But while I'm taking the questions, I'm going to put up these URLs, which have the link to the report, if you want to read the full 25-page white paper with all of the other detailed data analysis, the scan site itself where we have the statistics about the various projects and their progress, and then the link on the scan site that goes to the new architecture analyzer information where we have diagrams for over 2,500 different projects. Questions? You're all asleep already. Do I have any number for proprietary applications? There's actually a page in the white paper about that. But it is, in essence, the cop-out that you might expect, which is because we don't have visibility into our customers' applications, they don't share their code with us, we really don't have any way to come up with a number to compare. You know, we do know certain numbers, which is when we go in and do trials with commercial code, we see the initial number when we first run their code bases, and we find that that often sits around about the one defect per 1,000 lines of code mark. So even though Samba improved by, you know, about 0.4 defects per lines of code over the 2 years, they only started at 0.4 and they went to zero. So they were already, you know, better by half, you know, or more than half compared to a lot of the commercial code that we see on average. Yes?
So I'm also working on the wine project. Mm-hmm. We're also being checked by the Coverity.
Yes.
Thanks for that.
Well,
we tend to run into some special kind
Okay.
One of our policies is to be provider compatible. So we're still kind of trying to figure out what the best way to tell you guys about that is, because it's not invalid per se.
Right.
It is a valid null pointed reference that can happen. But
right.
It also happens on Windows, so it will never happen in a real application, because that would crash on Windows.
Right. Right. So when the developers are using the tools, they can set various status information as a record of what the analysis of this defect by the developer has turned out to be. And one of those possible state settings is intentional. And this is often used, for example, in test case code, where we dereference the null pointer because we wanted to see that we handled the exception case properly. And so if you mark that as intentional, it should make it easy in the interface for you to say, we don't want to look at these. We're happy with, we've dealt with them the way we meant to. You're welcome. Any more questions? All right. Well, then, thank you. Oh, Volker, yes?
Not really a question,